The fame machine moved forward without my help. It now had a life of its own. Every move I made was recorded. Photographers waited as I got off the plane. Snap, flash, ready or not, I was theirs. Alan hated this invasion of our privacy. I enjoyed it, but felt badly that Alan didn't. I was afraid that if we pushed the attention away, I would lose all that I had gained. I was afraid not to be the nice girl. Unfortunately, what you fear is what you draw to you. I was afraid of losing my fame. I believed I was my accomplishments. There would be lessons to be learned down the road, but I was living in a state of mild panic. If they knew who I really was, I was afraid they wouldn't be interested. I had a lot to learn and a lot of growing to do. At home, things were schizophrenic, wonderful and terrible. Alan and I were more in love than ever and angrier than ever. It was a passionate love, and I believe our passion kept us together during these rough times. In the spring of 1978, Alan suggested private boarding schools for all three children. Removing them from the Los Angeles area, where drugs and addicted parents seemed the norm, was a sensible idea. Part of me also felt that Alan saw this as an opportunity to avoid having to spend every waking hour with my child. I felt torn emotionally. It did make sense. It would be beneficial for all three children. But it also felt to me as though we were farming out our problems. Yet Bruce craved normalcy. He wanted order and routine. And at this time, I was not able to give it to him. I would cry into my pillow each night at the thought of sending him away 5 days a week. When Alan would try to comfort me, my body would become frozen. In my mind, I blamed him for the dilemma. I lost sight of the positives associated with this school. It had the potential to be a real opportunity. In the end, though, I decided to give it a try. The Ojai Valley School was a wonderful environment and challenging intellectually. Bruce and I talked about it for a long time. He was not anxious to go away, but we reached a decision together. He would try it for 2 weeks. If he didn't like it, he could come home immediately. If he was scared or lonely, I told him, I would drop anything I was doing and drive the 2 hours to Ojai and get him. He would come home every weekend, and he could use our credit card to call me anytime and as often as he wanted. I told him I would go with him and stay as long as he needed me while he adjusted. Since Stephen and Leslie were living at their mother's house, it was not for us to decide where they went to school. Alan suggested to his ex-wife that boarding school might be beneficial, but at the time she had a wait-and-see attitude. In the fall of 1978, when Bruce and I arrived at the school, we were directed to his room by a pleasant and kind-looking young man who would become one of his teachers. 2 hours later, he was settled in and was being called to his first school assembly. "Why don't you go, Mom? I like it here. I think it's going to be fun," he said. "Are you sure, honey?" I asked. "I planned on staying a few days." "Yeah, but there's nothing for you to do," he said, "and it looks like I'm going to be busy." "It's okay. I'll see you when I come home this weekend." "Okay, darling, if you're sure you're okay," I said hesitantly. "Remember, whenever you need me, I'll be here. I want you to be happy. If you find you aren't, we'll change things." I kissed him goodbye. As I drove through the village of Ojai towards the ocean, I felt hollow inside. I pulled into the parking lot at the public beach and got out to take a deep breath of ocean air. I needed to fill myself with something to remove the emptiness I felt inside. I sat at the water's edge with my head in my hands and sobbed. Tears and salt air mixed together and stung my eyes. Through the heaving of my aching chest, I asked the God of my understanding to help me know if I was doing the right thing and to please take care of Bruce and his pure, beautiful soul during this time. Things eased up a bit between Alan and Bruce. School gave them both space from each other during the week. Bruce came home on weekends, and I would try to keep my schedule clear to be with him, although it wasn't always possible. I knew enrolling him in this school was a positive move, maybe even an essential one. Yet I missed being with Bruce every day. He was my pal. I felt guilty sending him to boarding school, but he was flourishing as the school year moved on. I believe we seriously underestimate the severity of damage done to children of divorce. There is such pain involved when parents split up. Suddenly, the children no longer feel safe. Alan's children felt tremendous loyalty to their mother. They probably thought Daddy had left their mother for me. Why would they want to forgive me? They couldn't blame their father, because then they would have to face their feelings of anger and abandonment. It was easier to direct that anger toward a stranger, the new woman. And my behavior didn't help much. I tried to connect with Alan's children by being so nice and so kind. I'm sure my sugary sweetness made them sick. I thought I was doing everything I could, but in reality, my behavior was false, and his kids knew it. I was afraid to act the way I really felt. I was trying to be some kind of parent to them, but they didn't want another mother. Who could blame them? I hadn't even come close to earning their friendship yet. When Stephen came over on weekends, it was obvious he was not happy. He was usually sullen and brooding. It became obvious to us that Stephen must have felt threatened that Bruce lived with us, and he did not. I discussed the situation with Alan, and we decided to invite Stephen to live with us permanently. At that time, he was living between his mother's house and ours, whoever was serving the best dinner. It was annoying. He needed to choose to stay at one house or the other. After thinking about it, he chose to live with us. It was time to be with his father. It was a difficult transition for all of us, but it was the first step towards finding peace in our marriage. Now Alan had his own son living with him. Because of this, I hoped he would no longer hold on to his anger at Bruce. Then there was Leslie. Children will act out until they are understood, and Leslie seemed angry from a place so deep that even she couldn't understand it. I didn't know how to deal with her. There was something powerful about her, and it made me afraid to demand she treat me the way I wanted to be treated. Instead, I took out my anger at Leslie through Alan, in the same way Alan took out his anger over living with Bruce on me. Frankly, I don't know how our marriage survived dealing with Leslie, and I don't know how Leslie survived us. I had never imagined myself to be a wicked stepmother, but that was now my casting. Yet it was not all bad. There have to be some redeeming factors in every situation, otherwise you wouldn't put yourself through it. Every once in a while, we'd all let down our guard and for a moment see one another differently. We'd laugh together at Sunday dinners. Bruce and Leslie always really liked each other, and that helped all of us. My cooking brought pleasure to the family, and I would go out of my way to prepare everyone's favorites. I made Sunday dinners as often as possible, and I'd prepare wonderful things. Roast duckling with maple syrup and vanilla. Plum tarts for dessert. Cooking was all I could do for them. It was the only gift my stepchildren would accept from me. During this time, I ran into the mother of a friend of Leslie's at a clothing store. "How's Leslie?" she asked. "Fine," I said tightly. "I just love her. She is so sweet, so bright, so funny." It was an insight. Leslie had another side she refused to show me. I could tell by the woman's tone that her affection for Leslie was genuine. How I wished I could know the Leslie she knew. That one sounded easy to love. Maybe one day I will, I thought. I can't give up hope. I must keep trying any way I know how. Bruce continued to excel at Ojai, not only intellectually, but emotionally as well. Over the summer, he told me one day, "I have an A average, so I think I could get into the Thatcher High School for this fall if we enroll me right away." Thatcher was the other private boarding high school in Ojai and required a high academic standing for entrance. Stephen had seen how much Bruce was enjoying the environment at Ojai, so he asked if he could go there when school commenced in the fall. Both Alan and I were thrilled by his enthusiasm. Leslie was still not doing well in the Los Angeles school system and had been sneaking out of school with her friends. One day the principal called Alan and told him marijuana had been found in her friend's purse and that all the kids seemed stoned. When questioned, Leslie was defiant and insisted she didn't know anything about drugs. During my next hiatus, 1979, I was scheduled to star in 3 independent feature films. None of them was exactly the perfect vehicle for me, but Jay said to keep throwing projects against the wall until something stuck. He told me, "I want to spread you into so many areas of show business that it will take 5 years before you can possibly fail." This was what it was like working with Jay. He always interjected the negative to keep me insecure, to keep me needing him. Nonetheless, I was excited. At the conclusion of the Three's Company season that year, Alan and I, Bruce and Stephen, packed our bags and took off for London, England. Leslie wasn't talking to us. Earlier, she had deliberately gotten herself thrown out of the Ojai Valley School for smoking marijuana. There was a strict no-drugs policy, so she was immediately expelled with no tuition refund. Leslie was a free spirit. We had forced her to go back to Ojai for a second year, and she was not going to do anything she did not want to do. Now she was back at Beverly Hills High, which was where she wanted to be. We arrived in London and were met at Heathrow by producer Elliot Kastner's 1957 chauffeur-driven maroon-colored Rolls-Royce Silver Wraith. There are only two like it in the whole world, and I was told the other one belonged to the Queen of England. The movie was Yesterday's Hero, and I played a successful rock and roll singer opposite Ian McShane, an English actor who played an alcoholic soccer hero. I hardly needed to act in this one. I knew the dance with the alcoholic all too well. The promises, apologies, pledges to clean up his act. Then the broken promises, because I understood the only real love affair the alcoholic has is with the bottle. Everything else is a distant second. This was the first and only Jackie Collins novel to be made into a feature film. The rest have been television movies. When Alan first read the script of this movie, he said, "It's a piece of shit." He was right. It wasn't a very good script. But between the director and Jay, they convinced me I could make something of it. The director, Neil Leifer, was a famous American sports photographer and recorder of athletes and political legends. His photographs appeared regularly inside and on the cover of Life magazine. One of his most famous pictures was of him lighting Fidel Castro's cigar while Castro lit Neil's. "It's a lousy script," I told Neil long distance to London one night. "I know," Neil said, "but we'll rewrite it as we go along. We'll essentially throw this script away and we'll work from the outline. We can make it great, and I promise I'll take fantastic pictures of you." Jay went on to convince me. "It's an important career move," he said. "Nobody knows you in Europe, but everybody there loves soccer, so this is a way to get them to notice you." Alan still protested until Jay lost it and screamed, "We need a European movie. It opens up another whole arena for her." Jay and Alan were at each other's throats often those days. Whenever Jay had the chance, he'd take me aside and tell me, "We need to talk alone, without him. Alan's always there, and he doesn't understand you like I do. I can make the public know what a good person you are. That's what they will respond to. You need to be loved because of your background. I understand you, Suzanne, because I started in this business wanting everyone to love me." Whenever Jay would get me alone, my thinking would become confused. He'd make me feel that without him, I'd be nothing. But Alan felt that we should not be so anxious to jump into just any feature film. He thought we should wait until the perfect vehicle came along for me. "I'll support you in whatever you choose, Suzanne," he said. "I just wish it was a better project." Once in London, we met with Elliot Kastner. He was a nice guy with an agenda. Charming as can be, you couldn't help but like him. He was a transplanted New Yorker from Brooklyn and had produced hundreds of movies. A few were moderate hits, including Missouri Breaks with Marlon Brando. But mostly, he did movies that were released in Europe. Elliot had a friendly face and impish sparkling eyes, white straight teeth, his own, and a captivating smile. He was of average height and wore beautiful, hip, expensive clothes, like cashmere overcoats and designer suits, with the casualness of a rock star. Instead of a shirt and tie, he'd pair a t-shirt with a $2,000 suit. The making of Yesterday's Hero was a glorious job for me. Every morning, James, the chauffeur, would pick me up in Elliot's Rolls-Royce in front of the elegant and famed Dorchester Hotel. I felt like a princess. In the back seat would be crumpets and tea, jams and jellies, and I would nibble away as I was driven to the English countryside. While I was filming, Bruce and Stephen had a great time discovering London, which kept them busy since they had only a brief 2 weeks during their spring break. It was one of the few periods where their sibling rivalry dropped. They needed each other for companionship. London could be a big, scary city if you were alone, but together they took English cabs, rode the double-decker red buses, saw Big Ben, Windsor Castle, Trafalgar Square, and Harrods. It was fun to come home to my hotel at the end of each day and listen to them both excitedly replay their day's adventure. It was a glimpse into the possibilities of familial harmony. We were 3 weeks into shooting, and contrary to my deal, I still didn't have a paycheck. My contract specified that I would be paid at the end of each week of filming. Jay was home in America at this time taking care of Farah, so Alan took charge. "Don't worry," Elliot told Alan. "The new production office is not geared up yet. You'll get it next week." Alan had to be the bad guy. "Elliot," he said, "you've got to pay Suzanne, or I'm taking her back to America." Don't worry, Alan, Elliot answered reassuringly. I'll have it tomorrow. Hey, why don't you guys come to my house for dinner tonight? I live at Runnymede. It's the site of the signing of the Magna Carta. Tessa and I would love to have you. That was Elliot's way. He charmed the pants off of you. Tessa Kennedy was Elliot's mistress of 15 years. She was in her late 30s, blonde and great-looking. She looked like she could have been a former model. They had 2 children together. When I asked Elliot why he didn't divorce his wife, he said he didn't want to hurt her feelings. That was Elliot. Always padding his space. Always keeping the balls in the air. Never quite letting them fall, so no one could ever really get mad at him. So Elliot, Tessa, and their 2 children lived happily together at Runnymede, while his wife lived in a posh Mayfair flat. We'll see you in 30 minutes, Alan said to Elliot on the phone that night. Runnymede was like something out of a medieval fairy tale, a glorious 12th-century manor with a long driveway that had originally been used for carriages delivering noblemen. Inside was perfection. Tessa had incredibly good taste and was an interior designer, her biggest client being King Hussein of Jordan. The king sent for her regularly in his private Boeing 747 jumbo jet to fly her to the palace to continue redecorating one sumptuous room after another. Tessa was elegant, sophisticated, and aristocratic, a complete contrast to Elliot and his D's and D's Brooklynese. She graciously showed us around the mansion, each room lovelier than the one before. Priceless antiques, windows spewing brocades and silken tassels, Aubusson rugs everywhere, unbelievable art covering every inch of wall space. 2 perfect little English children appeared. The little girl was 5 years old and dressed in a simple white voile dress with stitching and smocking that only the most expensive stores would sell. The little boy was 7 years old and wearing gray pants, a navy blue blazer and tie. Good evening, they said as they curtsied. Well, Tessa said as she stood up and gestured toward the dining room, shall we have dinner? Where's Elliot? I asked, bewildered. Oh, said Tessa nonchalantly. He just got a phone call and he had to go to a funeral. Alan and I looked at each other confused. We had just talked to him 30 minutes earlier. Someone had died and was already having a funeral service within 30 minutes? At night? Well, that was Elliot. He'll be back later, Tessa said calmly. I felt like I was in the middle of a John Cleese English comedy. It was absurd. The table was set with antique Limoges, heavy lead crystal, and sterling silver. The table itself was a long mahogany Queen Anne that could easily seat 30 or 40 people. The 5 of us huddled at one end. The butlers brought us our dinner, each plate covered with a silver dome. Yum, I thought. I'm hungry. I wonder what we're having. Duck à l'orange, I wondered. Rack of lamb with mint sauce. Filet mignon with béarnaise sauce. None of the above. The butler uncovered my plate and I was staring at macaroni and cheese. Huh. Well, I said, trying to hide my surprise. It sure makes me feel like home. Haha. Isn't this a nice change? It tasted good, but the presentation was a little grand for such a humble meal. As we were having our gourmet dessert of vanilla ice cream, Elliot arrived. Hey, you two, he said with his charming grin. Look at that punim, he added, holding my punim, which is Yiddish for face, in his hands. Then he sat at the other end of the table, 40 chairs down, and started absent-mindedly polishing the mahogany surface with his napkin. Alan and I stared at him blankly while pressing our knees against each other's under the table in astonishment. After he showed us the spot outside where the Magna Carta had been signed, we went home. Elliot never explained his absence, and we never asked. Of course, the money wasn't there the next day, so Alan decided to pull the plug, which meant I would not be going back to work until Elliot fulfilled my financial contract. The phone rang in our suite. Alan, sweetheart, what you up to? Elliot asked innocently. We're going home, Alan said firmly. A deal's a deal. I can't let Suzanne work for free. Don't worry about a thing. I'll have the money tomorrow morning, Elliot answered sweetly. Okay, Alan said. When we have the money, Suzanne will go back to work. No problem, Elliot answered. Meet me in front of the Mayfair branch of the Bank of England tomorrow at 11 sharp, okay? All right, I'll see you then, Alan said matter-of-factly and hung up the phone. The following morning, Elliot met Alan in front of the bank. Elliot had payment in full for the entire movie, in cash. He handed Alan a large paper bag filled with money. You cannot open a bank account in England unless you live there, so Alan was stuck carrying the money himself. He had cash stuffed inside his underpants, t-shirt, even his socks. We couldn't mail it home. We couldn't leave it in the hotel room. We couldn't wire it into our bank account. We didn't feel comfortable keeping it in the hotel safe, so we were stuck with the cash. In the middle of shooting yesterday's Hero, we had to fly back to Los Angeles for me to shoot an Ace Hardware commercial that was to look like a fabulous Las Vegas show. Stairs, feathers, legs, dancers. It was like a marathon, all that flying back and forth, but at least Alan was finally able to deposit the money in our bank. At the wrap party for yesterday's Hero, Elliot was all smiles. "I had a good day," he said. "I sold this movie for more money than I got for Missouri Breaks. All because you are the hottest property in America right now," he said, pinching my cheeks. "Good," Alan said, smiling. "Then maybe you'll sell us your Rolls Royce. Suzanne loves it, and I'd like to buy it for her." "I'll do better than that," Elliot said. "I'll give it to her." Wow, I couldn't believe it. 4 days later, we were on our way back to America, and the Rolls Royce was already steaming across the Atlantic Ocean, delivered to Los Angeles, stamped on the side of its crate. 5 months later, we were back in London for the premiere of the movie. The critics liked it. It looked like we might have a hit. At the premiere party after the movie, a woman tapped me on the shoulder. She was well-dressed, but her face looked ravaged. She was holding a drink and appeared to be drunk, but I couldn't be sure. Her voice was trembling. "You've taken away the only thing that means anything to me in the whole world. You took my car!" Suddenly, Elliot appeared and his wife disappeared. "Hey, yous guys, having a good time?" Elliot asked with his usual charm. That's when I found out the car belonged to his estranged wife. "I'll send it back," I said in shock. "Nah, I've been wanting to get her a Jaguar. This kind of just speeded things up," he said, smiling. Vintage Elliot. When Jay had persuaded Farrah Fawcett to leave Charlie's Angels after only one season, ABC had pronounced him persona non grata. He would never work with them again. I was feeling the effects. Three's Company was the number one show on television, yet I was not asked to participate in the Emmys, which ABC hosted that year, or specials, or movies of the week. Anything that came up on ABC seemed to be closed to me. No one at ABC would return Jay's phone calls. He called me one day and said, "I've got an idea. I've decided to sell your hiatus. ABC is not sending you any extra work." So I called Bud Grant, president of CBS Entertainment, and asked if he would like to have a contract with you for the next 3 years. You would continue to star on ABC for the run of the show, but on hiatus you work for CBS on projects that interest you. You can do specials and movies of the week. The situation made me nervous. "I don't want to upset Fred Silverman," I told him. "He doesn't care about you," Jay said. "He just wants to get back at me for pulling Farrah, and he's using you to do it." CBS offered me a deal to have my own show called Suzanne at the end of my series. Before I signed with CBS, and without telling Jay or Alan, I called Fred Silverman's office to tell him about the situation, but he was out of town. So I was put on the phone with the senior vice president. I explained my situation, that I felt loyalty to ABC. They had been so good to me, and I needed to know what they wanted to do about this contract offer from CBS. Handling this myself was very naive. I should have left it to my lawyers, manager, and advisor, but I was still green to big-time show business. Jay, however, practically had my foot in the CBS door. I waited and waited, but ABC never responded, so finally we signed with CBS. Not a good move. It was big news. "Fred Silverman furious over Suzanne Somers' desertion to CBS," was the story in the trades. I felt awful, so I called Fred. "I talked to your vice president 10 weeks ago, and he never called back," I explained. "Yeah, well, you could have tried a little harder to get me," he said angrily. "How could you do this? I gave you your big break. Don't you think you owe us any loyalty?" he asked. "But I tried," I stammered, feeling upset. "Yeah, well, good luck," Fred answered, and he hung up. I was devastated. I had not wanted to create ill will. 2 weeks later, it was announced that Fred was leaving ABC and defecting to NBC, which had offered him a better deal. So much for loyalty. I felt angry with myself. But Jay also had another agenda. By signing with CBS, he would be getting his 15% of my future. If I stayed at ABC, he knew he'd be long gone before it was necessary for me to make any long-term deals. I'd walked right into this one. Now ABC had no need to nurture and coddle my career. Just get as much out of her while we've got her, was the attitude. I had a great idea last night, Alan said excitedly over breakfast one morning. What? I asked. You and 6,000 sailors. What do you mean? I asked. I see you singing and dancing on an aircraft carrier with 6,000 sailors as your audience, he said enthusiastically. That's a great idea, I said. I could immediately visualize the whole program. Even though America was not officially at war with any other country at the moment, we needed to rebuild the dream again which the Vietnam War had shattered. We had not been victorious at war for the first time in our country's history. The idea of rebuilding the image of our armed forces, while at the same time entertaining America with my own television special, was thrilling. Uniformed men not only look great, but they are also an enthusiastic audience. We'll hire the most beautiful dancers in Hollywood, and we'll work up a great act for you and your girls. Then we'll fly everyone to the nearest aircraft carrier to do the show, and the sailors will go nuts. I had been wanting to sing and dance all my life, and it was customary in the 70s to give hot stars their own television specials. It was a chance for the audience to get to know their favorite performers better and in different formats. The following week, Alan and I walked into Bernie Safronsky's office at CBS, which was now my new contractual home, to sell the idea. Bernie was the vice president of specials at CBS, and he was smart and likable. Suzanne and 6,000 sailors on the USS Ranger, Alan said. Let's do it, Bernie replied immediately. We'll shoot it next spring. Alan always says, when the deal is done, talk about the weather. We agreed on the idea, and Bernie told Alan to get together with business affairs to prepare a budget. Done. Nice weather we're having, Alan said, and I knew it was time to go. Now that Farrah Fawcett was separated from Lee Majors, she required more and more of Jay's time to handle her events. I relied upon Alan to take over when Jay wasn't available. My deals for the next 3 years were in place, and the bulk of my time was spent fulfilling those obligations. Jay is not really managing you anymore, Alan said one afternoon. All the calls are coming through my office. I've learned a lot from him, but I now have a clearer vision than he does of where you can go with your career. Maybe you're right, I said, concerned, but let's wait until after Christmas. And what a Christmas it was. Alan's parents came from Toronto, and I wanted to share our success with the whole family. I wanted to make this the Christmas that no one would ever forget. Never mind that Alan's parents were Jewish and didn't celebrate Christmas. Just to be with their son and grandchildren was enough for them. My mother-in-law, Margaret, loved me and had accepted me as her blonde Shiksa daughter-in-law and all that came with me. Alan was utterly devoted to her. I can't remember a day, regardless of where we were in the world, that he did not call her. 10 years had passed and Alan and I were now joined at the hip. It was clear to all that we were soulmates, even though we were still working out the soul part. She called us the lovebirds. I had tried so hard to make this a great Christmas. I even cooked dinner for 30 people by myself. I meant well, but inadvertently it was overkill, overindulgence to the point of boredom and embarrassment. It took 3 hours to open all the presents. The kids had so many gifts that they got tired of opening them. When I looked at Margaret, I could see she disapproved. I realized that I had done the wrong thing. Margaret had survived the depression. She did not believe in overindulging. She said nothing to me, but I knew what she was thinking. What about saving? Why are you spoiling the children? This is too much. On the other hand, I still did not feel worthy of my enormous salary. It was almost as though I was trying to get rid of it so I could feel normal again. I didn't see my talents as anything special. I saw Chrissy Snow as special, but I couldn't connect her with me. Before dinner, but after the Christmas morning gift bonanza, I had flown my entire family from San Francisco and had them picked up by a parade of limousines and brought to the house. As they entered, a mariachi band of 7 men greeted them. We danced, drank, sang, and nibbled on homemade, by me of course, appetizers in front of the 18-foot Christmas tree, which, naturally, I had decorated. Everyone laughed and had a great time except Leslie, who was now in one of her black moods because Alan had caught her with her girlfriend in his closet smoking pot during the Christmas festivities. It was as though she couldn't handle having a good time in our presence. After Alan's reprimand about drugs and sneaking behind our backs, she came to the Christmas dinner table with a scowl on her face. She toyed with her food and would not join in any conversation. To me, the black cloud of Leslie's mood darkened the dinner table. I lost control. The words just popped out of my mouth. "If you don't want to be here, Leslie, just go home," I said tightly, trying not to yell but not doing a very good job. I had had it. I was overtired from trying to make a perfect day, a perfect meal, a perfect house, a perfect Christmas. "I hate Suzanne," Leslie yelled at anyone listening and threw down her napkin. "I'm going home." Everyone at the table became quiet and uncomfortable. I wanted to cry, but I put on a happy face so as not to show my true feelings. I couldn't see what was really going on with Leslie, which I can only chalk up to my lack of development and understanding. I saw the situation only from my own point of view. I guess anyone who feels that she has to be Superwoman would have trouble gaining insight into a little girl ravaged with pain over the losses in her short life. In retrospect, a day like we were experiencing could only bring sadness. She might have felt badly that her own mother was not included, or she might have felt badly that she no longer had her mother and father under the same roof. When she was a child, her grandparents had stayed with her. Now they were with us, in particular with me. And nothing was the same anymore. At that time, people thought of divorce as something that happened to the parents, not the children. Yet the children of divorce are the biggest losers. The adults find new lives, and the children are expected to fit in. They all react. Some burst with anger, and some stuff it down like Stephen and Bruce. But the anger smolders and will eventually erupt like a volcano. After the new year, we taped one of my favorite episodes of Three's Company. It was the show where John Ritter and I accidentally got handcuffed together, and Chrissy had to go out on his date with him in a way that his new girlfriend wouldn't realize we were cuffed together. I think it is the funniest episode of all our seasons together. John and I laughed from our bellies all week. The whole idea of it was so absurd. It was pure farce, my favorite form of comedy. The ponytail on the side of Chrissy's head had started as an accident, because one year into the show, I had had a little problem. Every Friday morning, I would go to Vidal Sassoon in Beverly Hills and have Virginia bleach the roots of my hair white. Virginia was colorist to the stars, her biggest client being Rod Stewart. While the bleach was cooking on my scalp, Virginia was gabbing away on the telephone. Suddenly, she ran toward me with panic on her face. "Oops," I heard her say as she toweled off the bleach. She had left it on too long, and the hair on the top left side of my head broke off at the roots, leaving a huge bald spot. This is the stuff of lawsuits today, but I wasn't interested in anything but a solution. We solved the problem by bringing the hair from the other side of my head over the top of my head and catching it in a ponytail. Luckily for me, I'd inherited my mother's thick hair. Thus, the one-sided ponytail was born. On the night we taped the handcuff show, my studio hairdresser was having trouble getting the ponytail to look just right. We were running late. Mickey Ross, one of the producers, came storming into my dressing room screaming, "What's going on? Cast intros were supposed to be 5 minutes ago!" His anger level was totally inappropriate for the situation. He yelled so loudly I started to cry. "I'm sorry, Mickey, but we're having trouble with my hairstyle tonight," I stammered. "This is not a show about hair!" he screamed and stormed off. 5 minutes later, I was ready and standing backstage waiting to be introduced. I walked on stage as my name was announced to thunderous applause and screaming. "We love you, Chrissy!" the audience yelled. I looked out at them, and as my eyes adjusted to the light, there, to my delight, was the entire center section of the audience, filled with teenage girls, each one of them wearing the Chrissy ponytail. Well, Mickey, I thought, maybe this is a show about hair. As I look back, I now realize that the idea of a producer ever screaming at anyone is preposterous. That I allowed Mickey to do so was clearly evidence of my continuing lack of self-worth. I let him treat me like a child, so he kept doing it. It was control. The producers of Three's Company were intent on keeping us the kids. If we were good kids, we'd get a little pat on the head. If we displeased Daddy, we were in trouble. John Ritter was hot, doing features every hiatus. I was hot and doing the same. Joyce was doing TV movies, but not features, and that created tension. There was an underlying competition amongst the cast. We were each looking over our shoulders to see if the others were gaining. Because we weren't a real family, the generosity that exists in a real blood family was not present. The goal was to rise above our show, to become so ingrained in the public's awareness that the show became secondary. This was happening to John and me, and to some degree Joyce. All the magazine covers, interviews, television specials, and movies were building our story. All of us wanted to be sure that when Three's Company ended, we wouldn't end. Around this time, Barbara Walters called Jay to ask if I would let her interview me for one of her famous specials. Jay was enthusiastic. Alan was not. "She'll eat you alive," he said. He was worried that parts of my past would come up and I would not be able to handle it. "Give me more credit," I told Alan forcefully. "I can handle myself. I'll just tell her the truth." Alan was reluctantly convinced, but felt protective. The Barbara Walters interview was my most important public appearance up until that time and remains important to this day. Now, almost 20 years later, people still come up to me and recall that interview. Barbara is good. She interviews for hours and then edits down to the vital 20 minutes. She gets you relaxed and trusting. It's an important foreplay. Then, just as you start to sway back and forth, moving gently with the rhythm, bam, she hits you with a big fist. In my case, it went like this. "Barbara, I hate doing this, Suzanne, but, well, I really have to." At that point, she pulled out a topless picture of me, an ad that I had posed for years earlier, which I hoped would never surface again. I looked at the picture with horror, totally forgetting that the camera was on me in close-up. In that instant, the memories flooded back, the humiliation, the desperation. "Why did you do it?" I heard Barbara ask. I took my time to answer. Then slowly, quietly, sadly, I explained. "Have you ever been so poor, so destitute, that you had to sacrifice all dignity to get through your life? I was in my 20s and divorced. I was alone in the world with no means of support, and a child recuperating from being run over by a car. I had to do what I had to do to put food on the table. Taking my clothes off was a humiliating experience, but I had run out of options. The rent was due. I remember arriving at the job and deciding that I must be professional about the whole thing. I went into the dressing room, took off my top, and walked into the studio like it was the most natural thing in the world. Inside I was dying, but I was expert at pretending, so I smiled the biggest smile I could muster, hoping that by doing so we could take the picture of the happy nude girl and get it over with. I guess I've always hoped it would never surface, that it would be some kind of Secret Service job, but that's pretty naive thinking. I told her I was ashamed. I told her I was afraid the public would turn on me for posing for such a low-class picture. Barbara was quiet for a moment. I was overcome emotionally. I couldn't look up. I stared at my lap, wishing I could walk away and never come back. "Well, that explains a lot," Barbara said. "I thought you had done it recently." "No," I said, "no, it was years ago." "Did you write the poem about your son around that time?" Barbara asked softly. "Yes," I said. "Would you read it to us?" "Good," I thought, "this will change the mood." But instead, as I started to read the poem, it intensified my emotions. Tears were streaming down my face. "Sometimes I see my son and remember when I thought I'd failed because..." There was a long pause and then I had to stop because the words would not come. I was overwhelmed with feelings. I felt I would choke from the ball of tears I was holding in my throat. 3 times I tried to read the poem and each time my emotions overcame me. Finally, Barbara said, "I can't make you do this. It doesn't feel right to me." "No," I said. "No, I want to read it. It's important to me." Finally, I got through it. Sometimes I see my son and remember when I'd thought I'd failed, because so many told me a mother who bore a boy should not send away his father. Sometimes I see my son and remember the pain of unloved pregnancy and the resentment I sometimes felt at raising him alone when I could not have the freedom I deserved. There were days I was as much a child as he, when I wanted someone to give me the love I gave so grudgingly to him. Days that we learned together about life and had as many questions. Sometimes I see my son and wish his mother had it all together, to give him strength and courage I only sometimes have, to listen when my own hurts need hearing, to hold him even though I am alone. But sometimes I see my son with trust in his eyes that no one else could give, with a smiling, shining face that says, there was no failure, no monstrous mistakes, only good things and memories of love and caring. Sometimes I see my son and he touches me in secret corners, and I know that everything is fine and always will be. Sometimes I see my son, and I love him. The day after the show aired, Barbara was inundated with requests for copies of the poem. Once again, truth showed me its unbelievable power. People were different toward me after the airing of that show. Suddenly I had texture. I wasn't just that ditzy blonde. I was a survivor with a heart and a soul. I guess it's time, Alan said. It was 1980, 4 seasons into Three's Company. Let's ask Jay to dinner tomorrow night and we can discuss the whole thing in a civilized way. Naively, neither Alan nor I figured the dismissal of Jay would come as a major blow. He had to have been expecting this. We invited Jay to our house for a drink before dinner, deciding to use that time to tell him of our change in plans. Alan started the conversation while I sat on the couch of our office. Well, there's no easy way to do this, Alan explained, so I'm just going to tell you. We've decided that Suzanne and I can handle her career. Jay's face turned ashen. You've been great, I interjected nervously. I wouldn't be where I am today without you, Jay. It just feels that it's right to let Alan take over now. As I babbled on, I could see Jay's eyes becoming smaller and smaller slits in his face. The color in his cheeks flushed a strange combination of red and purple. The veins in his neck popped out. I had forgotten that the canes Jay always carried concealed a razor-sharp sword within. Jay stood up slowly, like a warrior preparing to attack. His voice was trembling and deep. "You can't do this to me," he roared, and with that he pulled the sword out of his cane and slashed it back and forth between Alan and me. His eyes were crazed like a mad dog's. I tried to reason with him while dodging. "Think of the good times," I said, ducking from his sword. My voice was high-pitched, nervous. "Think of all the fun we've had together." "I knew you'd do this to me. In the end, everyone leaves me," he yelled. Swoosh! Whish! I jumped onto the sofa, bending, weaving, avoiding his brandished sword. I never really thought he'd kill us, but Jay could be crazy and you never knew. It took 2 hours to calm Jay down and get him to put his cane away. Jay adored drama, but he was also truly upset. So was I. It had been a great ride with him, and I would miss his outrageousness, but not the head messing. I hoped this change would allow me to calm down and not feel so crazy. What did it matter who was on more covers each month? There was room for all the 70s girls. Farrah, Cheryl, Jacqueline, me. Jay had created the race. I wanted out. I also wanted out of the tug-of-war between Alan and Jay. I couldn't take it anymore. I needed to find some peace and some balance. Now Alan was in complete control of my career. I was pushing the envelope by turning myself over to him. Either the power struggle would find its balance in equality, or we would self-destruct, and a delicate balance it was. Alan understood my career better than I, so I needed his guidance. But at the same time, he was my husband, and I would not, could not, allow myself to be swallowed up by him. I had control issues. I had allowed my father to bully and badger me physically and emotionally all my life. As a successful woman, I stopped letting him push me around. I yelled back. I stopped accepting unacceptable behavior. And then I married Alan. I had lived with two people who were not going to give up control, and in that, I was going to teach myself to learn what I needed to learn. I find myself amazed at the inherent knowledge we all possess. Deep inside, we have an inner voice, and the messages are always there. We are always hearing them, but rarely listening.